This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Dirk Hayhurst has natural gifts as a baseball player, but they weren't fully appreciated in his native Canton, Ohio, where the only game that mattered was football. But young Dirk was the kind of guy who was more likely to follow his bliss than follow the crowd. So his passion for America's pastime grew and eventually led to a career as a professional baseball pitcher. He's had his ups and downs, played in the majors, played in the minor leagues, and like every pro player, he has dreamed of starring in the big game and winning it all. But last year, Dirk Hayhurst did something that he had never imagined. He became a New York Times best-selling author. His memoir, The Bullpen Gospels, Major League Dreams of a Minor League Veteran, was well-received by critics. Fans loved Dirk's honesty about the self-doubt that pro athletes suffer from. And his fellow baseball players admired how Dirk chronicled his life in the dugout without airing his teammates' dirty laundry. So earlier this year, Dirk Hayhurst joined the Durham Bulls starting lineup. Tonight, he hits the field as in the last of a series with the hated Scranton Yankees. But first, he's my guest on The State of Things. Dirk, welcome to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's take us back to those early years in Canton, Ohio, where you thought you were going to be a baseball player. What was it like growing up in Canton?
Oh, well, I wanted to be a baseball player, right, as you've said. But that was kind of like, oh, that's cute, kid. You should play football instead, you know. And then if you can't do that, then you can, like, downgrade to baseball. Wow. Canton, Ohio is obviously a football town. We've got the Hall of Fame there. And, in fact, that's, like, the big thing about the town. You've got, like, manufacturing in decline, potholes, chain restaurants, and really brutal winters. But you have football, you know, which makes it all better. And I wasn't into that. I went to a school where we had Ohio State Pride Day there. And so it was like mandatory, you know, it was like fascism. You had to wear the pride colors on Friday. And if you didn't, you know, you were a rebel, you were an outlaw. So of course, I didn't wear those colors. And I was expected to be a football guy. But I just didn't have the heart for it, which devastated my mom, who had been managing fantasy football leagues since she was, I don't know, like in diapers. So I went the baseball route, and I've been all the better for it.
Didn't have the heart for it, or were you a sort of a rebel at heart? I mean, was it a kind of act of rebellion to say, you know, maybe I do and maybe I don't, but here, I'm not gonna?
You know, man, you're like crawling in my head already, and the interviews just start. No, it's funny that you say that because I've always been the contrarian, you know. Like, I grew up in Indians country. I don't like the Indians. I like Ohio State. I don't like Ohio State, you know. I don't think I even like my own team. You know, anything I was told that I had to do,
right,
I didn't want to, like, I naturally wanted to go the other way and prove to somebody that you could do it the other way. It to a fault, you know, I would get myself in trouble that way a lot. But yeah, I think it was just so much that it was so pushy. In a small town, you're supposed to go a certain march to a certain beat, you know, because that's what everybody else is doing. And I didn't do it. And I, you know, you get so much attention for not doing it. And I love the attention for that. But it's always been my contrarian nature.
But now what happens when you do develop a love for a game like baseball where, you know, there are coaches, there are managers, and they're telling you how to play the game? I'm still in your head, right?
Yeah. I'm like, you know, how much do I want people to know that I fought with coaches when I was young and stuff? You get into it with them. I think, you know, I was young and I was talented. I had a superior talent. And that's not me being like, oh, yeah, I'm so special. But, I mean, there was really nobody else around in the town. It was a small place. And so I kind of stood out. And so there was some resentment there that I had stood out. And then, of course, because I stood out and, you know, I'm watching all these big guys on TV and they get to make the rules and do whatever they want, I thought that naturally I would get to do that too. And so you would fight with coaches and you would have your arguments in your small town about how your talent was superior and you should get away with whatever you want to do. But thankfully, I will say that I had coaches that were hard on me but not proselytizing. It's not like they wanted me to have good work ethic and they wanted me to play the game the right way. And they wanted to kind of squelch that arrogance early. Mm. And they did a good job of that without saying, you know, hey, Hayhurst doesn't like football, you know, let's hang him or something. It wasn't that bad. So,
but what about the whole business of this team play? I mean, the idea that you're the contrarian, you're not going to go on, you know, Ohio State Pride Day and wear the colors. What about your team colors for the baseball team? Was that hard for you to sort of get behind the whole team brotherhood, eat, drink, sleep, baseball?
Yeah, it was real hard, actually. Man, I feel like I should pay you for this therapy session. No, it was
See Robin on the way.
It was really, yeah, make checks payable too. No, it was really difficult for me because in the back of my head, I'm always questioning, you know, why does everybody worship this on a Friday night? Why is everybody getting? I mean, why do we come out in huge flocks to do this? I mean, aren't there other things that we could be doing with our time? You know, and if you speak that out loud, it's like saying, "What if there is really no God?" You know, in a like religious venue, and it has the same kind of effect. And you know, why are we all doing this? Shut up and keep doing it. You know, and I would always have that kind of outsider's perspective on things. And more often than not, especially in the smaller venues, getting in a lot of trouble. You know, he doesn't play the game the right way. He's about himself, or he doesn't have the heart for it, you know. And I did. I mean, I had the heart for the competition. I love pitching. But I just couldn't buy into the lifestyle so much. So
you make it to the bigs. And right now I'm talking with Dirk Hayhurst. He's written a book called The Bullpen Gospels. He's a pitcher for the Durham Bulls baseball team, has played in the majors. You wrote this memoir, and it really begins with your time with your grandma, your grandmother, who is a colorful character.
Everybody loves grandma for some reason, except grandma. She does not like the way she was portrayed in this book. It's funny, though, when she found out how she was portrayed in the book, her response wasn't, you know, it wasn't outrage that I'd, you know, lied, because I didn't. It was outrage that I didn't show her how to use the shotgun. And she would have never had to wake me up in the morning if I would have just shown her how to use the gun. After 5 years kicking around the minors, I had nothing to show for my life. I just had these five inglorious minor league years. And everybody thinks that's going to be awesome. It's going to be great. You know, just to have that story. Mm. And really, after I had the story, I realized how pathetic a story it really was. Because when the season's over and the Superman jersey comes off, I'm crash landed on grandma's floor. I'm sleeping on an air mattress in my grandma's house, you know. And I have no money. Minor leagues pay you nothing. And I have no love interest. I got a rusted out Honda. And so I'm stuck at her house. She's the only place I could go. She's got dementia, and she's nasty, nasty woman. But she's so much like everybody has that one grandmother, that like the one crazy grandmother, and then the, you know, hopefully they have the one good
hopefully
grandma.
Hopefully it's only one, yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe you'll read for us. Will you?
Oh, I'd
give
love
us a
to.
Sense of,
Thank
of
you. Sure.
Grandma.
Thank you. She hates pretty much everyone I know and is never shy about telling why. She hates all the presidents, all her doctors, the family, the guy packing groceries at the Food for Less, my girlfriends. None of them can do anything right. She hates the neighbors enough to aim that shotgun I told you about out the window when they set foot on her property. She's developed colorful nicknames for the folks on the block, like the endearing bunch across the lawn that she commonly refers to as that no-good pack of lying hillbilly Satanists. The satanic hillbillies, who own three large, friendly dogs, used to mow my grandma's yard for free until she stepped in dog poop. You should have heard the rant that started. She swore the hillbillies were training the dogs to hold their poop and leave it in great big piles in her yard. Mountainous piles. Dinosaur turds that suck your foot in like a tractor beam. She threatened to call the cops on the dogs. Then she threatened to call the cops on the neighbors. Next, she threatened to kill the dogs, and then she threatened to kill the neighbors. It wouldn't be long until there was freezer-burned dog in the fridge. She provided a roof over my head, and I was thankful, but my life with her was far from fantasy. She'll tell you that she treats me like a prince. She'll tell you a lot of things, like how she saved Einstein from the Nazis or that stretch of underground railroad beneath the house. What she won't tell you is how she keeps me in a sewing room on an air mattress with nothing but a card table and a suitcase. My princely suite is filled with her precious treasures, heirlooms, boxes and boxes of worthless bought-on-sale heirlooms she plans to pass on to us when she dies. I asked her if I could move a few of her artifacts out of my room in the meantime, and she told me no. I said I'd do all the work and she wouldn't have to lift a finger, but it was still a no. One day, I decided to move one single thing, a broken exercise bike about 10 years older than me. She called a lawyer when she found out it was missing. She was going to sue me for the cost of one dilapidated early 1970s exercise bike. She said she was going to use it, and I had no right to throw away her things. I asked her how much long-distance biking she planned on doing at age 91, and she told me to go to hell.
Dirk Hayhurst reading from his memoir, The Bullpen Gospels. He's a pitcher for the Durham Bulls, and he's written this memoir. If you can survive grandma, I suppose you can do pretty well in the major leagues, I guess. How long was that an incentive for you to work on your game a little bit, just to get out of the house?
Yeah, you know, there's a saying in the minors, and it goes, don't like it, play better. You know, because at the majors, you know, everything is supposed to be great and wonderful.
Yeah.
Actually, you know, I think it started to become this incentive for me to want to quit, actually, more than anything else. It worked contrary to it. You know, people always say, oh, the situation was so bad. It must have made you hungry to get out of there.
Yeah.
It did. But then I look at my career numbers in baseball and I realize it's probably not going to be through baseball. You know, what if this never works out? And so then you start thinking, what else can I do with my life? You know, I've never explored any other talents. You know, the interesting thing about baseball is it's one of those jobs you can't wait to tell people that you do, because it's a social icon status job. When they find that out, they think you're great. And suddenly your opinion is so much more important because you do it. And after a while of doing it, you start to look at yourself as the baseball player, and I'm valuable because I do this. Well, then when you start to really stink in baseball, it all comes crashing down, and you start to look at yourself, what have I really got? I mean, this title doesn't pay the bills. It doesn't get me anywhere. So I started asking myself, you know, what else do I have? And that's when I started to kind of think, maybe I should stop baseball and look at some other avenues.
We'll talk about those avenues and how you manage self-doubt when our conversation with Dirk Hayhurst continues. His memoir is called The Bullpen Gospels. More of that conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. My guest this hour is pitcher Dirk Hayhurst. He's a righty who's played for the San Diego Padres and Toronto Blue Jays and a number of minor league teams. Right now he's with the Durham Bulls. We talked about the relationship with your grandmother, which has got certainly a comical side to it. Your relationship now with your father was a little more difficult, a little more strained. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, my dad fell off the roof of our house when I was 13. And he hit the ground in kind of a funky way that resulted in a lot of spinal damage. So he became a quadriplegic for about 2 years. And then after rehab, he became a paraplegic. And shortly after that, he kind of got his walking back. And I would tell this to people, and they'd be like, oh, that's great. That's so wonderful, you know, and what an overcomer story. But I never felt that way. The accident changed him a lot. He and physically he could walk, but he was like Frankenstein, you know, and his hands didn't work right. They won't open or close. A lot of the fingers won't work on their own. A lot of the times his legs will just go numb and give out, collapse. And then I've seen him work in the yard, or at least try to, and come back in, and his legs will just be bleeding, and he can't feel them. So a lot of nerve damage, but that wasn't even so much the bad end of it. It was the psychological damage. You know, this is a kind of interesting parallel. You know, my father had kind of always gotten his self-worth through his work, and now he wasn't able to work anymore. Couldn't type a keyboard or anything. Couldn't weld or work with his hands anymore. So anyways, it was devastating to him to lose his identity. And he went into the severe depression, which would later become, you know, post-traumatic bipolar disorder. And when it got diagnosed right, and so he would have these amazing tirades where he would go from angry, destructive, like Frankenstein's monster, he would literally lumber around and smash things and scream, to just fall down on the floor and cry, and I want to kill myself. And this stretch, you know, it went on for years, and it kind of hit its apex about the time I was wondering if I should keep playing in ball.
What did you think you should be doing if it wasn't playing ball?
I don't know. You know, you look at that mess in your house, right, and part of me wanted to run from it, mm-hmm, I think is why I kept going to play. And part of me wanted to just quit everything and go get some mill job and pay for something, you know. And you feel powerless because you know that you can't fix your dad. And I think that's something that I actually discover over the course of the book is, you know, baseball is a powerful tool. It's a great thing, But it didn't matter if I made it to the big leagues or not. I couldn't take the big leagues and rub it on my dad and he'd be fixed. There was always going to be these horrible problems on the outside. You know, I guess the money might have alleviated some of it, but I wasn't going to fix my dad's broken psyche, you know. And so I realized, looking at my family situation, that there are certain things a job can do and certain things they can't. And I think if I would have walked away from ball in retrospect now, at that point, I think my parents would have really been crushed, because I was the golden boy and I was the one in the family that had a chance to get out and do something better. You know, my dad was a mess and my brother was an alcoholic still living at home at the time. And if they would have pulled me down, I think that might have been the nail in the coffin.
That question, though, is central to your book, The Bullpen Gospels, and one that seems to be deeply important to you, this issue of identity and the paradox of identity and profession, for instance, the status of a profession versus, often versus, your own true identity. When did you start thinking about those things? It seems to me that an athlete is told, you know, keep your mind on the game. When did you start thinking about these deeper questions of who am I really once the jersey's off?
You know, that's a great question. And it actually starts on the baseball field. When I would go out there on the mound and I would pitch well, it was great to be a baseball player. When you pitch like crap, it's no fun to be a baseball player anymore. And then you carry that with you off the field for days, that failure. It, over time, you fail enough, and the weight of that blow beats you down until you look at baseball and you start to hate it, because it can be such a wicked, cruel sport. It doesn't care about you, only what you do for it lately. And lately, I'd been just terrible. And so I get down to the bottom, and I'm feeling terrible about myself and this game I'm supposed to love, and I start asking myself, what am I? Who am I? What has happened here, you know? And that's when you look around and you see fans running up to you to sign things for them. It doesn't matter if you sign Bob Dole or Britney Spears on whatever they want. It matters that you're in that uniform and you sign something. And I start to get jaded. Like, anybody could put this uniform on and they would be loved for what they do. I'm not important to them anymore. Dirk Hayhurst, the person, does not matter to these people. And he's starting not to matter to himself. All that's starting to matter is this jersey. And that started to really scare me that I was turning into that. And I think that's when I kind of lunged back. Yeah.
And is that when you decided to write the book?
I think so. I think that that had a lot to do with it. You know, there's a huge media industry out there that loves to write about guys in uniform. And occasionally they'll get a juicy bit of dirty laundry to write about on top of that. And it makes for great papers and stories. And I'm reading all this stuff and I'm like, this is crap. You know, I mean, what is this stuff? Like, this doesn't show the real side. It doesn't show how we doubt. We love heroes and we love to watch them fail. You know, it's never anything in between. It's never, you know, they go home to broken families or they're scared or they don't know what the future holds. And the, you know, at the same time, here I am, like, angry at my own situation because I'm walking out exactly what I'm saying. I stink and no one cares about me because I'm not very good. Well, doggone it, does my voice not count if I'm not a great athlete? I think it still does. So I decided that I wanted to write something down. So that's like one major part of it. The other part was I was afraid that no one would ever care about me for anything other than baseball. So maybe if I, you know, I take this Hail Mary pass at a book, you know, maybe I'll score a touchdown with it and people think of me as something great at something else. So it was still kind of in that identity thing and raging against it at the same time, you know, that birth the Bullpen Gospels.
But weren't you scared that if you're going to write a book, what if it's a bad book? I don't even know how to write.
I don't.
It's a good book. It's well written. But going into it, you couldn't have known that.
No, I didn't. You know, it's an interesting process how it got started. I started writing a blog, and you know, my friends and family are reading it. It's very private. And they're like, "Oh, it's good. It's good." But they're my friends and family. They've got to say that. They tell me I pitch, you know, good when I get killed. I mean, they're obligated. So
if they hadn't been swinging at those balls, you'd have done fine.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. You know, well, why did they hit that? I should have known better. But they like it. But then I realized, you know, my friends and family aren't going to get me, you know, published. So I decided to take it to another venue, which was Baseball America, and Baseball America actually located here in the area. And they liked it. I wrote a piece for them called The Non-Prospect Diaries, which was the life of a player, not a non-prospect. The other, everything you don't see, the crappy bus rides, you know, the terrible food, the bad accommodations. But I made a huge mistake when I first started doing it. So you asked me if I was afraid of not being a good writer. What I was more afraid of was writing about a player and getting beat up, killed, or thrown out of the game or blackballed for it.
Well, and there were some suggestions when you started writing this book that that might happen, right? Tell us those stories.
Yeah. So I write my first article for Baseball America. It mentions one of the guys I roomed with as a snorer. That's all it said. That he, when he has a few beers, he snores really loud, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, the next day when I came in, somebody had printed out the story and posted it on every wall in the clubhouse and put one in every locker. With the bottom, it said, this guy's a snake. Stay away from him. Ooh. So now all of a sudden I walk in there and it's like the party stopped. The management grabs me, pulls me in the back room and says, hey, you keep this up, you're going to be done. We're going to get rid of you. You know, you're going to find yourself in a lot more trouble than just thrown out of the game. So I think to myself, well, I'm already on the way out, so let's risk it. Why not?
Plus, if they're this scared, I must be
onto
something, right?
I must be doing something right.
Right.
But that's actually when I discovered that you don't have to write bad about people to keep people interesting. There's enough good stuff in the game that you don't have to bury somebody to get a reader. And I tried to take that high road whenever possible.
And you do that, and you've changed some of the names when things got a little bit mm-hmm. dicey in the book, because mm-hmm. that it's not really meant to be a tell-all book. Were you able to regain the confidence of your teammates once you got going after that first episode?
I was. Thankfully, some, not all. There's always those few guys that, like, when I got to the big leagues, I got pulled aside, and somebody asked me, "Are you wearing a mic right now?" Yeah. I pitch in with recording equipment on all the time, you know. But there were some guys that were like, wow, this is really good. Mm. You know, I got a great story you should tell. You should talk about this. And then before you know it, people that don't want to have anything to do with you are starting to audition for your material, you know. you should sit down with me. And now I have guys, even in the Durham Bulls locker room, pulling me aside and saying, hey, my wife wants to write a book. You think you could hook me up with an agent, or you think you could read her stuff? Or it's really bizarre, you know. I mean, I do feel like I blazed a trail, but I like tumbled and fell through it, you know. It's more of like a bulldozing effect from me, you know.
Feels like that could be a scene in Bull Durham at the Mound, a conference at the Mound where they're opening up a section of Jane Eyre. So, listen, let me ask you this, though. When this business of confidence is also something that's very important to you, and maybe one of the things that other players appreciate, that we're not talking so much about steroids. There's some, not steroids necessarily, we're talking a little bit about the seamier side. We've got a little profanity and a little bit of late night play, but it's not so much that as what guys do with the doubt that they have. And you just don't imagine athletes, particularly at the professional level, even having these. All we hear about is them, man, you know, they're tigers, they're going to win every game, they mm-hmm. never lose. And so it's what goes through your mind, and I've always wondered this, how does a pitcher with, you know, and he stands there and he watches that ball sail over his head and out into the parking lot, and it picks up the rosin because, you know, there's another batter right in front of him. Mm-hmm. How do you even do that, you know, and throw, because now I got to throw strikes, and that last one just went to the parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk a lot about that. That's an important part of the book. And I think revealing for people who watch pro sports and don't know that athletes go through this.
Well, there's a saying in baseball that you have to have a very short memory, extremely short. You know, the role models aren't supposed to ever doubt. They're supposed to be heroes all the time. That's not true. Role models are great at confronting doubt and overcoming it. At least that's what I feel. Baseball is a game of success. You see that all the time. In fact, that's what we like to just broadcast out. Oh, this guy's a winner. He's a winner. He's a winner. He sells my product. He sells my shoes. He looks good with my razor blades, you know. But baseball's truly, in reality, a game of failure. 300, 3 out of 10, that's a great batting average. You know, you're going to give up runs, but keeping your ERA low is good. You know, strikeouts to walks, there's always that failure rate. It's always good in relation to failure. And so as a player, your best asset isn't your fastball or that great swing. It's how you overcome the failure. And the best players, they don't fail as much as the others, but when they do, they pick themselves up and they go forward. And if you don't have that trait in pro ball, you'll learn it. And if you don't learn it, you won't be there for very long.
The other side of the game that we're looking at, too, is the the difference between the minors and the majors, guys getting there, particularly if they've been drafted, they feel like they're big prospects. This notion that I'm going to start building in the eccentricities right away and create kind of a star persona for myself, which doesn't really go over so well in the minor league locker room.
No, it doesn't. It's funny that you bring that up. You have to earn the privilege to be eccentric through success. And the only real success that matters is the success at the big leagues.
Well, you know, there's a scene in Bull Durham, right? The catcher, Crash Davis,
yeah.
Right? He's sent to the minors to groom this young hotshot pitcher, Nuke, to the major leagues. And now he's in the locker room in this scene, and Crash is analyzing the state of Nuke's filthy shower shoes.
Think classy, you'll be classy. If you win 20 in the show, you can let the fungus grow back on your shower shoes, and the press will think you're colorful. Until you win 20 in the show, however, means you're a slob.
So the younger guys have a hard time managing this clash of cultures?
Oh, that's such a great line. I mean, just I wonder if people realize how good that line is, how expose quality it is baseball. Not to rabbit trail here, but, you know, Jamie Shields is in the big leagues right now, you know, and he made this shirt called Big Game James, you know, Grande Huego. He's even got his own Spanish name for it, you know. He gave the nickname to himself. He made the T-shirts of himself to give away. I mean, if you were in the minors, your entire paycheck would be gone in Kangaroo Court Box. But he's in the big leagues throwing shutouts, and so it's awesome. It's so cool. Everybody wants to be a part of it, you know. But that is a prime example of when you earn that at the top, all your character flaws, they become these beautiful little nuances of your persona, you know, and everybody wants to be like you. When you're in the minors, it just means you're flawed. So, oh, yeah. And young guys do have a problem with that because they feel like they're going to get drafted and go right to that star status. And, of course, there's six levels in the minors they have to slug through first.
Well, it's been a blast to be inside your head, but I do want to get inside baseball for just a second and talk about the hierarchy in the minors, because we're right there. We're talking about this. You know, a guy like Crash Davis, he's not a prospect anymore, but he can play a role. He can bring somebody along. How does that work? A single A, double A, triple A, that's the hierarchy in the minor leagues. Is it sort of good, better, best? Or where do the major league teams plant their best prospects? Is it in triple A ball? Is it in double A ball? Where do they go?
Well, it's not a question of one level being better than all the other levels. There's something to be learned at each level. You know, it's you want your prospects to come along gradually and make their adjustments and learn and glean. And so you start with kids fresh out of high school in the lowest levels, and then you get to the higher levels where you have men with experienced big league track records, you know. But I think we were talking about before the show, we had prospects going to double A instead of triple A. And a lot of times that happens because triple A can be a very bitter place. You have guys that have come down from the big leagues. They're stuck in triple A. They hate being there. They feel like they should be in the show for somebody. And this kind of festers in them. And before you know it, every time they open their mouth, you have poison that just comes out. So you take this guy and you sit him right next to the guy who's can't wait to be in the show because he's a big time prospect. He got signed for millions of dollars. Someone's going to lose their job if he doesn't get up there. And he's excited. And the older guy's like, don't be excited, kid. They can't wait to screw you over once you get up there. And so it ruins that hunger. And you want that hunger to succeed in the big leagues, because when you get up there and you're the new guy, it doesn't matter if you're a prospect or not anymore. Now you got to perform or guys are going to wear you out. So a lot of times they'll shelter him based on the climate of a team. But most of the time, if all the team's climate psychologically are positive, then they just kind of naturally progress all the way up to the top.
Now, you're playing with the Bulls now. They're farm team for the Tampa Bay Rays. And you're down here. You had a shoulder injury, right?
Correct, yeah.
Yeah. So what are your prospects? What do you think is going to happen next for you?
Gosh, man. Let me look into the crystal ball and try and give you an answer there. I had shoulder surgery. I'm fully recovered from that. I had some elbow issues earlier in the season, which was like, oh, here we go again, you know. I don't know, to be honest with you. I know I have a big fan base of readers that want me to get up there because they think it would be so novel. Get it?
Yeah, I do. I do. It's very literary.
Thanks. but I am I'm not sure. I'm not sure what I'm going to do. You know, I'm not as talented as some of these young kids that are next to me now. But I know that I still have a role to play.
I wonder what that's like, though, you know, getting back to this business of the more experienced guys who almost made it or maybe didn't get sent down, younger guys, you know, what that kind of chemistry is where there are some guys maybe they just know they're not going up. They're playing with other players who truly expect to play in the major leagues. I mean, what does that do for the chemistry of that particular team? I mean, I've always wondered about the managers of minor league baseball, how difficult it is to have people at two ends of their career trying to play for a team. This manager really wants to win games, I assume.
Oh, yeah. Charlie definitely wants to win. Well, it's difficult. I can't speak from the manager's perspective because I'm not a manager, but I can tell you as a player, it starts to become more selfish, really. Mm-hmm. And what people, you know, you hear the word selfish and sport and team, and you're like, oh, outrageous heresy. But honestly, you're talking about guys' lives now, not just, you know, this isn't just high school or whatever. This is the rest of their life. So a lot of these older guys have families, they have kids, and they've got to go someplace that has the best option for them. And so they become ruthless about protecting their arms and trying to get out. So it's tough for a manager because he's looking at guys with families and lives, but he's also looking at a responsibility to an organization that's paying him to get the best of the top with an ethic of winning.
On the State of Things today, my guest is Durham Bulls pitcher and best-selling author Dirk Hayhurst. His book is called The Bullpen Gospels, and we will continue our conversation on the State of Things in just a moment. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking this hour with pitcher Dirk Hayhurst, author of The Bullpen Gospels, Major League Dreams of a Minor League Player. And we've talked a little bit about the game, and you've been pretty serious about talking to pitchers about not always looking for the strikeout, that's not always the most important thing as a pitcher.
Oh, yeah. Bring that one up. Gosh. I got roasted by all the baseball world saberists for saying, don't try and strike everybody out, even though Crash Davis says, don't try and strike everybody out. And most of these guys, like, they grew up on that movie and they love, you know, that statement. But, yeah, stop trying to strike everybody out. It's not that difficult of a concept to really think about. Because it's an intent. I think I look at it from the pitching standpoint, not the analyzing the outcome standpoint. But when you're a pitcher and you go out there thinking, I'm going to strike everybody out, often what happens is that you go max effort right from the get-go. You try and throw that nasty pitch you've got over and over again to get the swings, and you don't learn anything. You don't learn about the batter. You're always throwing you're pitching basically for your own amusement there. And honestly, experience is the best, you know, teacher. That's not going to get the job done for you at the higher levels because batters are going to make adjustments for you. Throw your best pitch in the zone over and over again and see how long it stays your best pitch, you know. Go out there and throw max effort and see how long you make it into the game. And what people often forget is there's a cumulative effect attached to this during a season. If a guy goes out there and tries to punch everyone out, throws his arm out, throws way too many good pitches, one, that great pitch that he's in love with that got him drafted, that starts getting smacked around. And then he loses confidence in that. And now he's afraid to throw strikes altogether. The walks go up. The bases are full. He comes out of games earlier. Now he's a suspect and not a prospect. If you come out of games earlier, you run your bullpen out there to pick up for you. Now their arms are hanging and their career is in the balance because you just can't locate a fastball down and away and let somebody roll it over to shortstop. So it's a learning mechanic. It teaches you don't fear contact, learn from it. Because a lot of times, if a batter wants to hit and you want him to get out, he'll do all the work for you. You just have to supply the pitch.
On fewer pitches. You can
exactly.
Get him out on one pitch
exactly.
if you know where to place it. How long did it take you, and what was the process for you in learning that lesson?
Oh, it didn't take me very long. I didn't have strikeout stuff, so I got beat up a lot. But there became a certain satisfaction with a changeup, you know, throwing the slow pitch up there and watching guys swing and miss or pop it up or something. And, you know, I think the great thing is that you have guys in the big leagues, or at least I did when I was coming up, like Greg Maddux, who didn't have to rely on power arms. They could nibble and get their outs. And people would say, oh, he's a professor. Look at him. He's an artist. You know, he's out there just playing the hitter like a violin. And I always thought, wow, that'd be cool. I want to play the hitter like a violin, you know? But I was kind of forced that way because I didn't have the stuff to go the other direction. Whereas some guys, they've got, you know, mid-90s fastballs, power, curveballs. They can go the direction of the strikeout pitcher. The problem is, rarely do you have a guy that can strike everybody out and go the full distance in a game. Usually it's one way or the other way. If you're the power arm, you're going to get a limited sample out of the pen. That's why guys who can do both always get hundreds of millions of dollars to play in the big leagues for a long time. So they're rare. But saberists and fans are like, if you could strike everybody out, you should do it. You should be that guy every time. I can't. So I'm doing what I can with what I got.
You have written this book, the Bullpen Gospels, and you have a second book ready to come out. What's that book going to be about?
Actually, you know, we've talked a lot about some of that subject matter already, and we didn't even know it. The second book is called Out of My League. It'll be out April 1st of next year. And it covers my time in AAA, which ironically, not AAA with the Bulls, but AAA with the Portland Beavers in Oregon, and what it's like to come there hungry for the big leagues and run into these bitter guys who've kind of been thrown out of heaven, and all of the fears of what's going to happen once I make it there. But on top of it, I meet my wife, and we're going to try and get married in the same season. And then I get to the big leagues, and I find out it's not the heaven you thought it was going to be. You know, they tell everybody in the minors, do what you do that got you, you know, whatever you did that got you there, do it again. That's what you should do in the big leagues. But then when you get there and you find out you're not allowed to talk to anybody, you're not allowed to go in the training room, you're not allowed to sit in this plane, you know, plane seat, you're not allowed to be at the front of the line, you know, all this stuff. There's so many unwritten rules. And then you realize that the big leagues, which you thought were going to fix everything, makes it worse for a lot of people. And there's a lot of things that go up, that go, you know, down up there, like guys cheating on their wives or drinking or drug addiction or stuff. And it wrecks them. Sometimes the big leagues is the worst thing that's ever happened to some players.
And it's a lot of, I mean, the players who make it there obviously were the best kid in their little league. They were the best kid in high school, and they were probably the best player in college. So it's pretty tough, I would think, for athletes to finally find the league where they could be in the middle of the pack. Is that part of what's going on there?
Well, it's certainly something that happens. I don't know if necessarily it happens in the big leagues. It usually happens earlier than that when you find out that every team has a star guy that's probably as good or better than you, you know, just depending on how the ball bounces that night. And that's a tough moment for a lot of guys to go from all-star to middle of the pack moment. I mean, but ego is something you have to balance in this game, just like your physical ability on and off the field.
You talked about meeting your woman who would be your wife, and then you got married. So she was not necessarily a baseball fan, so she was now having to be brought into the culture.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, I could write a book on that. It's so funny when you sit down with your wife and say, honey, the guys in the locker room were selling complete box sets of porn. And I just want you to know I didn't look. But it's there. I'm not looking at it. So I don't want to lie to you. And then she's like, You should lie to me. Lie to me. Don't tell me any of this. I don't need to know this, you know. But you want me to start lying to you early? Because you're gonna see all these things that you're never allowed, you're forbidden to speak about, but they're there nonetheless. And a woman involves a different.
Well, and then I guess she sits with the other wives at the games, and then their conversations become strained.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay, so the filter, you know, I tell a story to my wife in confidence. Now my wife has this story, and she's going to filter every other wife's story about it because she knows what their husband is up to based on me. But the other wife knows what I'm up to based on her husband. And so you have these really shallow, pathetic conversations that really boil down to nothing but, oh, yeah, I saw that show, and, yeah, I like Jersey Shore, and that purse is cute, you know, oh, and your husband's cheating on you. You know, and it becomes that. And so there's these cat fights that break out, and, yeah, it's a scary place.
And she wants to know what they've got on you and is dying to figure out how to get it and how to get that all together. So the second book is coming out, and you're working on a third book, right?
Yeah, I've contracted to deliver two. Go figure. I honestly, when this book was all done and, you know, the Bullpen Gospels sent in, I was like, please let me sell 10,000 copies, because then it won't be a bust, you know. That'd be great. But now it's sold well over 120,000 copies, which is awesome. And I have deals for two new books. And the third book is a book tentatively titled Strike Out the Devil, where my blunders as a evangelical Christian in the sports world. Basically, me trying to get people saved through concussion, you know. And
what does that mean? You trying to get people saved?
Yeah, me bashing them over the head and trying to – basically, if you put a competitor in a religious atmosphere and you tell them it's your job to go out there and win souls, well, I'll go out there and I'll try, you know, and through the most ridiculous, stupid ways possible. And spirituality and sports, they don't mix in the ways that you would think they would. For instance, you know, a slump buster. Have you ever heard of that?
Mm-hmm.
This is when a guy pursues a rather homely looking girl in hopes that he could, you know, court her into some sexual behavior.
Got it.
And then by doing so, his slump at the plate will suddenly be busted and he'll start hitting again.
They really believe this?
Yes, they do. Yes, they
this
do.
This is some kind of primitive.
No, it's not. There's the
okay.
You can pitch drunk. You can come out of the bullpen hungover, and if you get a zero, your slump is busted for a pitcher. Uh-huh. There's all sorts of stuff. So imagine if you come into a locker room and say, you know, Jesus doesn't really want you to do that. But baseball has its own rules, its own behaviors. And when you come in with, you know, your spiritual agenda, it makes for some heated conversation, because you feel like God's telling you to fix these people, and they're saying the only God I bow down to is the baseball gods, because I'm trying to get to the big leagues and I'll do anything that gets me there, whether it means sleeping with slump busters or, you know, attending mass every single morning. You know, it becomes ritual.
Well, so then the trick is to find those slump busters in the gospel, which are
there. You go.
A little more abstract. So now that's interesting. Well, what did that do for you? Then it didn't change, or did it change your faith, or just the way you approached it in the clubhouse?
I think it changed my faith, actually, because I came from a church where people said to me, you know, God has given you these gifts so you can use baseball as a platform to win souls, to strike out the devil for him, basically. And so I went with this agenda into the baseball world, and I'm trying to win these people, and I'm trying to tell them that behavior is wrong. It's sin. People don't, you know, they don't like you, et cetera, et cetera. I made no friends. People stayed away from me. No one wanted to talk to me, you know. And I'm coming back to my church saying, what am I doing wrong? Oh, nothing, nothing. You're bearing your cross for the Lord, you know. And slowly but surely, I'm separated from both groups. I'm like the man in the middle with nobody. And that was really tough. So I realized that I was young when this happened. There's more to your faith than just bashing people over the head and trying to add a tally on some leaderboard in heaven, you know. And people that tell you that's all it's about are really missing some of the genuine articles of what it means to be a follower of Christ, to pour yourself out in service of others, even if they're dirtbags, you know, that want to sleep with slump busters. And so I realized it's not my job to point out the sin of all these guys. Maybe it's my job to just love and care for these guys, regardless if they get to the end that my church think is great, which is salvation. Maybe I'm just supposed to care about them. And so when I did that, oh my gosh, you know, people are coming to me, you know, meet my family, meet my kids, you know, and there's no agenda. So I learned that lesson the hard way.
And you talked about it changing your faith. It seems to me there's a parallel here from your early observations about the way people promoted sports. It's about the colors. It's about standing up, whether you and you know, shouting out and being at the pep rally. And you came to sports from a different point of view. And then, in a sense, your faith fell into that same model and things starting to converge for you.
Mm-hmm. It's wow, you're really good at pulling this stuff together. That's impressive correlation. I've always done my best work when I look at things differently than everybody else. And I take a lot of flack for that. You know, when you step outside the box, you're always going to get hammered. I've got hammered on for the way I look at sports, the way I look at writing, and the way I look at my spiritual life. But I've learned through failure, and not just easy failure, acute failure, but hard, grueling, you know, chastisement. And when you can look at the sports world or the spiritual world from outside of it with a sense of awareness, you can see what a great tool it is to make people's lives better, enrich their lives, and enrich your own lives. But if you are just stuck in it and you think all it comes down to is the amount of beer I can drink, what I can buy, the colors I wear, the amount of cheers, you're missing the point of it. It's a great experience. Don't get me wrong. I would never judge anybody for doing that. But sports is so much more than that. Faith is so much more than winning somebody over. And it takes a certain degree of awareness and fearlessness. Not that I'm trying to, you know, blow myself that I'm so special or whatever, but it takes that level of awareness to really use it the right way, to really help people or even help yourself.
And through all of this, the image of the Garfus has emerged. Tell us about Garfus.
Oh, man. On another completely unrelated subject.
No, you see, I'll pull it together if I have time.
Okay, great. The Garfus is this character I made up. He's a half giraffe, half moose that breathes fire. He's the protector of the sacred baseball grove deep in the Tibetan mountainsides. Of course, right? Where nature's most perfect pure baseball are grown on trees and bunches.
Okay? So you see spirituality and baseball come together in the Garfoos. All right, keep going.
The Garfoos is a very special creature, and actually that's why it was created, not because I wanted to write this story, but my wife works with special needs children, and I wanted her to have a mascot that was special. So I came up with this Garfoos, which was special, you know, and he had all these cuddly, unique characteristics. Well, those characteristics did not fly in the baseball world. No, no. For a pitcher in the AL East, this Garfoos needed to have some weapons at its disposal to protect itself from the Yankees lineup. So it had teeth and, you know, laser vision and Wi-Fi, and, you know, it's indestructible. It could beat Chuck Norris in a fight, no problem. And so the canon of the Garfoos grew. But originally, I just wanted to make this creature up for my wife so she had something special to stand out for these children so she can make puppetry and stuff like that for them. And it had a really humble beginning. And now it's like I have bought the copyrights to the image and the name because people ask me to draw it on their paraphernalia when I sign. And I've worked on a couple inverse rhyming children's books that have just never seen the light of day because I'm too busy working on other stuff. But I don't know what's going to happen to him. But
how do the kids in her classes respond?
Oh, they love it. My wife says she's the Groovy Garfoos. That's her therapy company, and they love it. We have sock animals, you know, and they say Garfoo. You know, they get their name. It's fun.
Hey, how's your father doing these days?
You know what? He's better. I won't say he's perfect, but he is better. My dad finally got diagnosed the right way. They got him on some medication that has balanced him out a lot. He still can get very angry. He's always had a temper. I mean, you're never going to, you know, neutralize that. But he's happy more. I mean, it used to be, and you could see it when you look at him. Just his face would be gray. He would get up in the morning and he'd just watch the clock to wait for the seconds in his life to unwind. You know, it was really hard. Now he gets up and stuff he wants to do. He's got friends. You know, I introduced him to Facebook, and, you know, he's got friends at the comic book store now. And every once in a while, I go in there with my big league writer paycheck and I'll buy all of his comic books. And he feels like a dad again instead of this broken person living at my parents' house.
What do you think of the book?
He loved it. He loved it. And you know, that was scary for them because it talks a lot about my parents, but they're really glad that I used this story to help other people, because a lot of people have read the story of my parents and been touched and they feel empowered by it. And my parents are glad to know that their brokenness could be used for something positive.
Dirk, great pleasure to talk with you. Good luck tonight against the hated Scranton Wilkes-Barre Yankees.
Thank you, Frank. I appreciate
that. Good to talk with you. Dirk Hayhurst, pitcher for the Durham Bulls. His memoir is called The Bullpen Gospels, Major League Dreams of a Minor League Veteran. You can find out more information at DirkHayhurst.com. And if you want to see Dirk in action tonight, check out, this season anyway, DurhamBulls.com for the team's schedule. StateOfThings.org is our website. You know our schedule every day at noon and 9. Check us out on Facebook as well. State of Things is produced by Alex Granados and Jeremy Loeb. Anna Cassell is our intern. Robin Copley, the technical director. Managing editor, Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.